Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're once again recording from the Firehouse World 2010 out in San Diego, California. I think for Brother Mike, this is day five. For me, it's day three. We look outside. You see a few clouds, blue sky, but the best when you see where you're walking, you are not walking on slush, ice, or snow. So that's a great thing. So for our listeners today, here's the rundown. We're going to do a couple of questions of things that have come in to the website over the course of the last 30, 45 days. And we have a very special guest with us today as a result of being down here in San Diego. We're very fortunate to have Captain Chris Ulrich from the Los Angeles City Fire Department. He's a station commander of Fire Station 87 out in the San Fernando Valley and operates a tractor-drawn ladder and two engines. So it's going to be pretty interesting to hear Captain Chris talk to Lieutenant Mike and find out how their ladder company operations are similar and differ. And when we get to the engine stuff, Mike will probably just have to shut up and listen to what Captain Chris has to say, because that's where Mike's...
Brother Tom.
Yes.
I just have to ask our illustrious guest, Captain Chris, where do you ride on what piece?
Well, the commander rides on the truck. Mike.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's all that needs
to
be said.
That's a no-brainer.
No-brainer.
That's a no-brainer,
okay,
Mike.
Here we are in the bottom of the first, and it's Mike and Chris 1 and Tom still coming up to bat. All right. So launching into the program here is a couple of questions. This one came in saying, Mike, hey, hope you're doing well. At a department that I took over as chief, I have a 1972 Sutphin aerial tower, and it was referred back in 1994, but still has open jump seats. I would like to get a set of gates for the doorway opening to prevent firefighters from falling out, but can't find anything in catalogs or online. Do you happen to know of any company that still sells or manufactures man bars or these gates? Any information that you can supply would be greatly appreciated. Well, to Steve that sent that in, for the listeners, here's just some brief things. Since 1991, when the NFPA 1901 standard required all cabs be fully enclosed, and we understand it with the Sutphin Tower, because of the design of the aerial tower, much like the Baker aerial scope of the day, and the way the pivot point at the back part of the tower actually overhung the engine box, you just don't have enough room to put a straight-up rear wall and enclose that in a four-door cab configuration very easily. There was at one time a couple of companies that built these jump seat gates, and they were pretty prevalent probably up until the early portion of the decade that we just left in the early 2000 era, because they realized a lot of people were still operating late 70s or maybe 80s vintage rigs that were open jump seats. And they actually were gates. Now, a company based out of Long Island that most people, our listeners, are going to be familiar with, Fire Research Corporation, still does make those, as they refer to them, I actually think the name is trademarked, was Mansaver bars. And about the only place you see those used now occasionally are for those people that want to have top mount pump controls where they've got walkways, and they sometimes put the Mansaver bars there, or occasionally at the back around the pedestal on a turntable if they don't want to have something a little bit better than just a dangling chain going across where the stainless steel railing is. So the best advice here is that while there were a couple of companies that built them and all you had to do is dimension out what the roar opening was, the best thing you could probably do in this case is, since the unit was built by Sutphin, is to contact them, or for a listener that, you know, for example, had any other particular brand of apparatus, the gentleman who sent the inquiry in is correct. I mean, there's not anybody that just makes them anymore for two reasons. One, it's been many years. You know, 91, we're talking about 19 years ago, the four-door cab standard became a requirement. And secondarily, for those people to continue to supply that stuff, there is certainly some implied liability that they realize that you're trying to retrofit something, and, you know, there may be some issues there. So in that case, if you happen to have a fire apparatus refurbishing vendor in your particular area, though there may be some opportunities there for those people to custom build a a safety bar, a safety gate or door. I know in the Connecticut area, people actually referred to them as Mr. Ed doors, that you'd have to be of the vintage to remember that television show where it was a half door and a Dutch door, so Mr. Ed, the friendly horse, could poke his head through the top and he couldn't just walk away. So fortunately, we don't have something to say, oh yeah, go to this website and you'll find it, but there's the answer. Now here we got one for Michael, and this has to do about a response protocol. Gentleman's name is Mark, and I'm deputy chief of a volunteer department in New Jersey. I have a question for you as follows. What is your opinion about responding lights and siren? That's the way we'd refer to it back east, out here in the west. I guess they would call that code 3 response to two different types of calls. One, a CO alarm with or without reported illness. And then the second one is responding to a mutual aid call where your apparatus is going to stand by at a neighboring jurisdiction. You're not being called into the scene or to go to staging, but that you're going to be going for a station to stand by. All right. Goes on to say that their SOGs currently say that they're a non-emergency response, but there is some dissension or discussion in the department that feels that they should be going lights and siren to those types of calls. So, Mike, your experience based on best practices or from a legal perspective, what's your opinion on those instances?
Thanks, Brother Tom. The answer is quite clear. The law is quite clear. The best practice is quite clear. The U.S. Fire Administration has an Emergency Vehicle Operator's Course Guide. And in that course guide, it describes and defines in great detail what an acceptable true emergency is. And a true emergency is defined as an incident by virtue of your driving where you are going to be able to save lives and property by virtue of driving Code 3, like out here in the West Coast, or a lights and sirens response. When you look at a carbon monoxide detector, I liken it to Pavlov's dog. When you rang the bell, Pavlov's dog would eat. When you ring a bell, firefighters all of a sudden think that they have to jump behind a vehicle and tear through the streets of their towns and cities with lights and sirens and run people off the road and put everybody at risk. And that's just simply not the case. Unless you have a CO detector going off and somebody has a headache or appears to be ill, or another symptom of CO poisoning is that they sound drunk on the phone, or there's a neighbor calling that said that there's a problem, that somebody is sick. This is just simply a non-emergency response. It's a bell going off, an alarm going off that could be true or not true. And if we are going to err on the side of caution here, and it doesn't muster that definition of true emergency, and so we are going to go no lights and no sirens. And again, people don't realize it's not like we're going to go, not going to go at all. We are going to go. We are going to check out the scene. We're just not going to interrupt the regular flow of traffic, and we're not going to put everybody on the apparatus and around the apparatus at risk for no particular good reason. And if you look at our protocols and our procedures for handling CO emergencies, it becomes quite laughable in a lot of cases. In a lot of cases, when you call in for a CO alarm, the dispatcher will tell you to open up the windows and leave the building. And then what do? We show up with our $800,000 ladder truck or heavy rescue. We jump off with our gas chrononometer that measures everything, including fart gas, and we end up rushing in and measuring fresh air, and we look very, very foolish. And there's just no reason that should be a lights and sirens call at all. When we go to standbys or relocations or fill-ins or whatever your particular jurisdiction calls them, I think I have 21 names now on what the U.S. Fire Service describes as that action of taking a fire truck from a full fire station and putting it into an empty fire station. Captain, what do we call it out here in the greater Los Angeles area?
It's called a move up out here, but yeah, we're covering for a company that's busy or a set of companies that may be at a working fire.
So there's many different terminologies: move up, move over, catch up, standby, relocation, fill in. What's the Maryland term? I forget, brother.
Transfer.
Transfer. You have a transfer in the state of Maryland in the greater Washington D.C. area. So it's coined a lot of different names, but it's still the action of taking a fire truck from a full fire station and putting it in one area or one jurisdiction that's stripped in and providing a fire service. And again, that is just simply not an emergency response. As a captain or a lieutenant like myself, or particularly a chief officer, you would be hard-pressed to explain to somebody's family why your truck ran them over and killed them. When you're trying to take a fire truck from a full fire station and putting it in an empty station, it doesn't muster even close to being any kind of emergency whatsoever. And that is simply just a non-emergency, no lights, no siren, no code 3 response.
Mike, I know there's been several incidents, including one that I know happened a number of years ago, kind of out in my neck of the woods, where an upstate New York fire department going to a fill-in or a move-up was going lights and siren and killed someone while they were responding through an intersection. Whether it was that incident or any others that you know of where somebody had been legally cited for, imprudent actions as a result of an activity like that?
Well, if you go to our website at www.emergencyvehiclerespondents.com, and we are in the early stages of March, the first several incidents there have to do with legal matters with ambulance drivers and apparatus drivers facing some kind of legal action. In the case that you cited, I recall that there was an incident near Darien Lake.
Correct. Okay. That's the one I was referring to.
Right. And I'm not sure of any legal action there, but what I was told, and I got this secondhand, is that the driver of that apparatus, the whole set of circumstances were interesting because the apparatus was going to stand by at a station that was out fighting an abandoned silo fire. And it was a father and several of his daughter's friends that had gone to a birthday party at Darien Lake. They had left. They went to the intersection at the same time that this standby, this fill-in company, was going to fill in. And there was a terrible crash, and there were, I believe, a couple of deaths. And this is going back many years now, so I'm trying to recall off memory. But in any event, the driver in this very small upstate New York town was actually shunned by the town. And after a couple of years of being shunned by the fire department and the town in this horrific accident, he actually committed suicide. So just a very, very sad state of affairs and something that didn't need to happen in the first place if the proper procedures and policies were followed and the rules were followed.
Well, leading into that, we're going to have a little Q&A here again with our guest, Fire Captain Chris Ulrich from the Los Angeles City Fire Department. And I guess as compared to a lot of East Coast operations where you walk into a fire station and you see X number of apparatus there and the assumption is that everything is fully staffed in one fashion or other. Particularly, if you walk into an FDNY fire station and you see an engine and a ladder, there's X number of people assigned to that, but yet they are considered to be individual companies. And not that I'm an expert in this, but that's why we're going to start, just for the benefit of our listeners, to a little quick snapshot of the way the LAFD operates. That, as I understand it, Captain, you have single engine fire stations. You have fire stations you can walk in, and people refer to it as a light force, LIGHT force, and then there are task force stations. So if you just, for the benefit of our listeners, describe the differentiation there and how that works.
Well, let me correct that a little bit, Tom. And by the way, thank you and Mike for having me here today. It's an honor to sit here with you guys. And we really have two types of stations, task force station and single engine stations. Within a task force station, the complement of equipment, an aerial ladder truck, tractor-drawn aerial, and a two-piece engine company can respond in two different ways, or actually three ways. You can respond all together as a task force, it can respond as a single engine company, or it can respond as a light force. And let me clarify that a little bit. The truck company, Truck 87, for example, my truck, has an engine company with a driver, just a driver. The complement of my crew is rides on the truck with me, and the driver's back there on that engine by himself. Sometimes we put another guy back there with him, but he's married to my truck all the time. He goes where I go. The engine company has another officer on it, a Captain One, and that engine can respond alone. My light, when that engine's gone, now what's left in the station is what's called a light force. And we can respond to another. We can respond to an auto fire because we've got an engine with water. We can respond to a heart attack. We can respond to a structure fire. Whatever it is, we still have the capability of the engine. So I don't know if that clarified
that, that's things. Good. In some of the being a little bit of a student of history, it seemed to me that this whole concept kind of goes back to the era of the war years during the riots, as I understand, as it was under Chief Ray Hill, that when Los Angeles was under siege and everything operated as separate companies, that's when they decided, let's initially just for safety of the firefighters while these civil disturbances were going on, that we placed the companies together. And the basic operations were so successful that with modified over the years, that's basically the procedures you've...
That's absolutely correct. The Watts riots brought about the task force concept. And they're running around putting out all kinds of structure fires here, there, and everywhere. So they married up a truck with two engines, and they had, you know, of course, the complement of people was they had a lot of extra people because they were throwing them on the rigs those days. But it worked very effectively. They had a law enforcement contingency that went with them, and we used this model in the later riots when I was on the job, but. But yeah, this task force concept came about, and it worked so well, it spun into a regular configuration for us on the LAFD. And the other thing that it does for us, Tom, is when we get the wildland fires burning, and really what we need is engine companies. We can open up that second engine. It's got a complete complement of equipment and hose. It's identical to the front engine. We can basically bring in a couple of people, or we can even close the truck company.
Oh. Oh.
And I realized that's heresy. Okay, I know it.
Now we've got a reaction.
That's serious. It causes my heart to palpitate to think about that. But, yeah, we could take those people throwing on an engine. In L.A., we have 47 or 48 task forces in the city, and about 55 engine single engine stations. So, but in a very short period of time, a matter of just a few hours, we can have almost 50 more engines in the city, which is a great help.
So every one of your ladder companies operates then, Captain, in a task force contingent.
Yes.
Right. You're not going to go. You can't find a fire station like there are several, not a lot in FDNY in some East Coast cities. I know in Baltimore where you can go in and there's one fire truck in the station, and it's a ladder truck. That doesn't exist in your jurisdiction.
Nope. You're either a task force station or a single engine station.
Okay. No, so what kind of staffing then goes along with this? Take us through that on your and at your station at 87s. If I walk in there and there was somebody sitting in where they were supposed to be, how many people would we see on each rig?
All of our engine companies have a four-member complement. It's a Captain One, an engineer who drives, and those are both promotional positions, and two firefighters. And then within those engines, some of them are what we call assessment engines. We might assign one paramedic to that unit, so you might have a firefighter and a firefighter paramedic. That they're dual function.
Okay.
And then on the task force companies, we have 10 members assigned to the task force. So you've got an engine company with a complement of four, a captain and two firefighters and an engineer. On the truck company, you've got the senior captain or the captain two, which is my position. What we call an apparatus operator. He specializes in driving the truck and operating the aerial ladder.
So that's a different position than the engineer?
Yes, it's different in our city. It's a different promotional exam, and it focuses on truck work and all of the things that go along with that.
You probably have to be smarter to have that.
Much smarter, Mike.
Smarter,
I mean, you know, push water through the hose. You know, that's the engine side.
Right. Yeah.
The truck is, it's
so,
pretty.
So if I'm going to look at the promotional hierarchy here, I go from firefighter, paramedic, engineer, and an AO, an aerial operator, typically would have more time on the job and is a.
Well, it used to be that the engineer outranked the apparatus operator. Yes, I know. And that was just wrong. There actually is a tremendous amount of responsibility on both the engineer and the apparatus operator. We kid about this, but it became apparent that this is silly, okay? That guy that has that aerial ladder in his hand is can hurt somebody bad if he doesn't know what he's doing. And so they really brought those two promotional positions into parity with one another. They make the same money, same bonus, and so on and so forth. So
what about the operator of the tiller enclosure? Is that part of the promotional process? Are they considered an assistant, or how does that work?
It's not promotional for us. All of the firefighters are trained. After they get off probation, and even in the final months of their probation, we begin to get them out and we teach them how to tiller. So any firefighter, any member of our department can jump up in the tiller bucket and take that truck down the road. Often, if we go out on a medical call and it's an extreme call where we've got guys working on a patient, frequently that'll leave the apparatus operator and myself. So I'm either going to drive the truck or I'm going to jump in the tiller bucket and head to the hospital where we pick up our guys. So
very interesting.
Yeah. So
staffing levels, you've got, including yourself, 5 on the truck,
right,
4 on the engine, and then one person driving
right.
the second engine, the 200 series engine, that in any given incident, he's really marrying up with you folks if need be.
Right.
And all your ladders are tractor-drawn, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. You don't have anything else other than tractor-drawns?
Nope. All tractor-drawn aerials.
Well, it's pretty strong staffing compared to a lot of organizations. We did, for the listeners, Mike and I were very fortunate the first day out here. We did a 8-hour ladder company operations class, had close to 40 folks, very diverse group from Canada to Washington, Oregon, folks from New Hampshire out in our neck of the woods, and staffing levels on the ladder companies, because we surveyed everybody in the class, range from 0, you know, not staffed at all, 1 if they had an extra person, to on the heaviest side, it was someplace up in Northern California, they ran 5. But the average was pretty much 3, and there were a good number of guys that were running the Q word that we won't speak to today, but that actually ran with 2, so... By those standards, from that little snapshot, you folks are pretty fortunate.
You know what I find fascinating is that you hear this awful difference between East Coast and West Coast firefighting and East Coast and West Coast truck operations. One of the things that I find interesting is just the way that you respond in the task force. That's not unlike what we do in periods of unrest. We have a whole procedural guide, and we form basically...
You form groups, right?
Right, a group.
Right.
And I'm going to really probably screw this up because I'm not sure. It's either 2 engines and 2 trucks or 2 engines, a truck, a battalion chief, and then we have 2 police cars.
Mm-hmm.
And we all assemble at a predetermined point, and then we'll go into the area of unrest and do what we need to do. So it's...
I really think it's interesting if you get, again, you look at what people's procedures and policies are, and I mean, more often than not, they're rooted in some experience they had in the department's past that caused them to evolve to that. And while Los Angeles was doing that in the 60s, when I was very young, attending the University of Maryland and caught the last year of the student riots, they were doing the same thing. We assembled down at the University of Maryland Training Center and teamed up 2 engines, a truck, a chief, and some National Guardsmen, and that's how we operated. And I'm sure that idea just didn't come out of College Park, Maryland. That was certainly came across the country, and people saw what you were doing out there and said, that's probably a pretty reasonable way to operate.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, and it's interesting. You were talking earlier, Tom, about all of our vehicles now being enclosed in the closed cab. The most recent riots in the city of Los Angeles, there was a reserve truck that was being operated in and around things, and the apparatus operator got shot. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yes, I do. I do recall that, yep.
He was hit in the neck. He's a captain now. He's come back to duty. He's a great guy, but he took a bullet in the neck. They were aiming for the officer, and it missed the officer and hit the driver. And they literally drug him from his seat. The captain reached across, hit the column brake, and slowed the vehicle down. They drug him from his seat up onto the engine cowling and got a hand on his neck to control the bleeding. And they continued. They hardly ever stopped moving. Another guy jumped in the seat, and they went right to the hospital. And that probably undoubtedly saved his life, you know, because
wow.
they acted quickly. But
wow,
I'm not sure they could have done that in the current vehicles, the way they're configured,
yeah, yeah,
you know.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I'm curious with another question with regard to staffing levels. With the shifts that you worked in for the firefighters, the two people on the engine and the I guess three on the truck, do those people always ride on either the engine or the ladder all of the time, or is it captain's discretion, or do you switch up so these guys get experience on both sides? How does that work?
We rotate those members. Almost universally in the city, we rotate them. And sometimes it's on a matter of maybe a three-shift segment for them, or it might be on a monthly basis.
Okay.
But, my guy will come up into the tiller seat, and he'll be there for a month. And then he'll rotate then over to a nozzle seat on the engine so that they get experience in all of the positions, and they can basically pick up that job, whatever particular SOP for that position is. They're
the drivers, they remain constant, though?
The drivers remain constant. And the other thing we try to do, Mike, is we give the young guys opportunities to act in a driver's position.
Okay.
Often we'll take them out, and in non-emergency situations, they'll drive us to fire prevention inspections or to the market to pick up our daily food and whatever we're doing. We orient them to driving, and then slowly we work them into a position when the captain's comfortable enough that they can actually act in an emergency situation. They demonstrate proficiency with driving and operating the equipment. Then we sign them off. And if, for example, I've got an apparatus operator that goes down for a medical or he has to go to some detail, then I can pick one of my fire guys, put him in the spot, and we continue to operate. So.
Very interesting. So with the single engine and the task force concept with the staffing levels, and what kind of response would you see? If you have a captain, if you've got a single family detached dwelling, mm-hmm. how many companies or how much apparatus is that? You know, again, back east, we're used to saying, okay, we run four engines, two trucks, a squad, and a BC.
Right.
But it sounds like your system here, you've got different options.
Yeah, we'll have a single family dwelling. In my district, we'll get a task force, the equivalent of a task force. And bear in mind, if my engine's gone, they're gonna count my truck company or my light force, if
okay.
you will, as part of a task force, and they may marry us up with another one. Well, I say that loosely, but we're gonna get a task force, a second engine, a battalion chief, an EMS supervisor, and an ambulance.
Okay.
That's what we call an A assignment.
Okay, so you're actually getting three engines, you're getting the truck.
Three engines, a truck, a battalion chief, and then some peripheral.
Okay. All right. We take that, move that up a step. We're now into a garden apartment, multifamily.
Right. Now into a commercial occupancy or an apartment
okay.
building or something. We bump that up a task force. We call that a B assignment.
Okay.
So two task forces, an engine, another battalion chief. And depending on the nature of the call and if we're, you know, if it, the dispatch, all of our dispatchers are firefighters.
Okay.
And that's a luxury that we have that really is great because guys can hear the calls coming in and those guys are good. They know if it's a good call or not. And So they'll start anticipating that. They might even move companies and knowing, hey, this is a working fire. They're going to get on scene. They're going to need some help. And so they'll start shifting companies around to anticipate that. But okay. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
That's very, very interesting. I've also heard the term, again, because back east people will tout the size of the fire. It was a third alarm, a fourth, or a fifth, and like most things, the higher the batting average, the more catastrophic the event was. In your terms, I've just heard people say it was a major emergency.
Right.
What is that?
Well, a major is a fire that goes above 15 companies. So we go from a first alarm fire, or the first dispatch, and then it anywhere from that first A or B assignment that goes out, additional companies between that first assignment and 15 are considered a greater alarm fire in the CED alarms. So if I get on scene and I tell our dispatch, OCD we call it, give me another task force and an engine, I'm still below 15 companies, but it's considered a greater alarm fire.
Okay.
Automatically, when I do that, they'll dispatch another battalion chief for support, and they'll give us what we ask for. You get up to 15, and most time you're going to get a division commander that's going to come in, and he's going to assist some of the chief officers, and you get pretty good amount of people there running the fire. So.
Let me ask this question. When you go to a major fire and you have the engine that goes with you with one person, do they establish water supply by themselves then, or what's their task in this?
Yeah, what happens, Mike, is that second engine can be used. Normally, we use it to augment the supply of water on the hydrant. So if we're laying in, we got a working fire, we've got a loom up, a column of smoke down the street, then that engine company captain, he's already looking for that hydrant on the map coming in. So he'll stop. Usually it's down at the corner, or if it's mid-block, we'll pick up that one. But if it's a working fire, sometimes we stay away from the mid-blocks because they tend to be smaller mains. But a captain worth of salt, he's got that hydrant marked, and they roll up and they stop. One of the firefighters will get off, will dump the supply line, the 4-inch supply line off, pull it out of the bed. It's got a pre-connected 4-way valve on it, and he'll loop that hydrant, if we're running as a task force, I'm talking about.
Right.
The second engine with the engineers behind him, and then that firefighter gets back on the engine 87, let's call it, and down the street they go in front of the fire. Okay, the truck's already down there. We've spotted for what we're going to do with our aerial, or if it's a single-family dwelling, we're going to get the truck out of the way and make sure that we've got room to get our ladders out the back. And so now the engine lays down the street. That firefighter hasn't had to waste any time hooking up to the hydrant. The second engineer comes in with his rig, spots to the hydrant. He'll disconnect that 4-way valve. He doesn't need it. He'll plug it right into his discharge, and then he'll take suction off the hydrant. And then he'll watch. He'll communicate with his water buddy, the other engineer down there. He's late. He's stopped. They've pulled some slack out of the bed. Break it into the suction on engine 87. The back engine, by the way, we call our 200 series. We didn't mention that before.
Okay.
So you've got engine 87 in front. They've got the complement of captain and personnel. The second engine we call our 200 series.
So it's actually engine 287.
Engine 287.
Okay.
And so that engineer, then he makes the connections. He waits. As soon as he gets a signal, so it can be a hand signal. It can be a radio signal, load the line. And down the street goes the water. Now, he can adjust pressure because we have, and I'm sure it's this way in other parts of the country as well, but, some hydrants are low pressure. Some are extremely high pressure.
Right.
So he's balancing that need for water down in front of the fire.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, Captain, which, again, is very, very unique based on East Coast standards with most examples, that all of your ladder companies are all tractor-drawn or tiller units, but make and model. You ride on what type of unit in Station 87?
We've got somewhat of a variety of aerials now, but our fleet is, fortunately, our fleet is pretty new. I have a American LaFrance aerial with an LTI ladder on it, And it's a beautiful truck. We're very happy with it. We've got, years ago we used to have Thibaults, and we've had all different manner of aerials, right. Seagrave aerials. And
the engine 87 and 287 are what make and model?
We've got engine 87. The frontline rig is the newer rig, and it's a Seagrave. I believe it's an 07 Seagrave. And the 287 is a 99 Pierce.
But as you mentioned, they're equipped identically.
They are, okay. Yeah. I mean, the body design is a little bit different. But, when they write the specs, the our compartments are fairly consistent. Our equipment is very consistent. And even to where we put them on the vehicles, the equipment is usually mounted in the same place. And what the other thing that happens for us is we get, we constant staff our seats. So often we might have a firefighter in from another station that's working 24 hours with us, or he might come in to cover for some guy who's going to a medical or something. So that guy, if he comes in and I tell him, well, you're on the nozzle or you're the inside truckman or whatever you are, and I make that decision based on that member's experience and, okay. and where he'd been. But that guy's going to come in, he's going to sit down, and he's going to basically know where to go for a piece of equipment he needs.
So even if he came from another station, he doesn't have to, wander around the rig and kind of figure out what...
He better wander around that rig. I'll expect him to do that. But, he could walk up to just about any compartment and have a pretty good idea what he's going to find in that compartment. Yeah.
And that's a same across the board when we get back east to the FDNY.
Yeah.
We get detailed members in and...
Yep.
They're expected, whether you're an engineman riding in a truck or a truckman riding in an engine, you're expected to be assigned a position, and you're expected to know where those tools are and what that position entails. And if there's a fire, you're expected to do your job.
And they'll come up, the guys will come in, and they're usually pretty good about it. They'll get their gear on the rig, and they'll check out the rig, and then they'll come up and talk to one of us. They'll talk to me, or they'll talk to the captain on the engine, for example. And say, hey, Cap, I'm so-and-so, here's where I am, here's how much time I got on the job, you got any special ways of doing things or things that you like to see, any special instructions for me today? And so it's good. The guys are usually pretty responsible about their job.
I've only had a couple of opportunities to go out, and whether people call it buffer, to go take pictures of some rigs in LAFD, but one of the several experiences I've had, it just be ingrained with me forever, is I've walked into the station, and no matter who greeted me at the door, was immediately taken to get introduced to the station officer. And when I told them I had an interest in the apparatus, they would assign me to the engineer or the aerial operator. And whereas I can tell you, in a lot of jurisdictions, Mike and I would go visit, and you'd ask them a question about the rig, and then something as simple as, how much supply line do you carry? And the guy would give you a number that you knew was incorrect. These people knew, your engineers and aerial operators knew everything about the unit, and once you started opening compartments, you could immediately see the pride in that unit, in the way the units were cared for, and the equipment. I think we mentioned before we came on the air, the only task force stations that I can recall going to, one was at 39s and 88s, and the aerial operator was showing me the hand tools. I mean, you've never seen hand tools that clean and that well taken care of and mounted. You didn't see, for example, on the engine, all the adapters sitting in a milk crate that had been stolen from a local 7-Eleven. I mean, stuff was well taken care of.
Thank you, Tom.
Yep.
There actually is great utility to that, too, and Mike, I'm sure, would agree. We've learned down through the years that, you take care of it, and when it's time to use it, it's there for you, and when you know where it is, and you need it in a hurry, that's extremely valuable. So
it becomes a company pride.
Yes, it does. That's exactly right.
The rig has Los Angeles City on the side, but it also has that number 87, and that's your company.
That's right.
It just instills that pride that it's my company. And one of the greatest things that we were able to do over the course of my career is that for years we did not pay our operators any more money. And we did not have the buy-in that I think that we needed. And so over the Well, it's been 15 years since I got promoted. We started to pay our operators more money, and I think they do take a little bit better care of the rigs, and they do take a little bit more interest, and there's more buy-in because of that. And I had always wished that we would have a system like yours where we could get a promotional rank out of it, that it would be a precursor to being an officer.
Right. It's, yeah, that's, I think in the fire service, if you're thinking about safety and you're thinking about doing it right for the citizens and you're thinking about protecting your people, then, yeah, you have a guy that demonstrates, he goes through a promotional process, he puts a lot of his own time right. off duty into becoming that. You give him incentive to do that with that pay increase. And it's not a lot for what they for the responsibility they take.
Absolutely. And so, for our listeners that haven't had the opportunity, if you're out on the West Coast, and I'm sure there's some other departments as well, but just speaking from personal experience, and if you look at what has happened with some apparatus-related incidents within the last year, going from the city of Boston and everything that was reported about on them with the just complete, utter lack of maintenance on the apparatus, and having folks that, while they were well-meaning in their motor pool, weren't even trained mechanics. What happened just a couple days ago in the city of Detroit, where they park a ladder truck on a railroad track and didn't think anything of it till the train came by. And then you go out and you look at a Los Angeles City unit, and if that pride and morale doesn't jump out at you right away, I don't think you're looking at the right thing. So,
Tom, listen, before you get too much past that, I'd be remiss if I didn't say we had it happen to us years ago. We had an aerial ladder parked on the railroad trucks and railroad tracks, I should say, and so it happens. There are situations that the guys get into that, on the surface, sometimes sound like, what was that guy thinking? But you know, the fire ground, as Mike knows, is a chaotic situation. It's often dark. We don't quite see and don't have good judgment about things that are going on. And fortunately for us, this train came down the track and it hit our aerial ladder at a low rate of speed. It was something that was talked about for many years. So,
well, Chris, in your career, I'm sure you've seen a lot of safety-related issues kind of come and go. If you think about when you came on the job in the late 70s, it was still rigueur du jour, certainly with your great climate out here, open-cabbed apparatus.
Yes.
You know, guys riding in rear jump seats, you know, with their BAs.
On tailboards,
right,
I rode.
Right,
I responded
right.
on tailboards.
Right.
You know,
rode on tailboards, and over a period of years, in some cases, depending upon the jurisdiction, driven by the civil disturbances that we talked about. We started with plywood roofs, which I know that L.A. did, and New York did for a while, and it evolved. At least in the case of New York, they were some of the first departments ever to be doing four-door cab apparatus in the late 60s, and it wasn't because of somebody was telling them they had to do it. It made pretty good sense to do it. But with the safety-related issues that you've seen over your career, and again, for our listeners, Kurt and his brother have developed some pretty neat technology for things that Mike and I had gotten introduced to a couple of years ago. And it's one of the things that we're just, I think, need to become deadly serious about is that if we have an incident or an accident or a tragic line-of-duty death, to do whatever we can to take the learning lessons from that after the burial and the sadness and the pipes and the drums go away and everybody sheds a few tears to say, what are we going to do to get smarter so we do not allow history to repeat itself again? So with that introduction, Chris, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the product that you and your brother have developed with reverse control and what really the impetus to that was.
Well, Tom, I appreciate you your interest. We, in August of 2004, I was on duty at Station 70, Task Force 70, and there was a tragic backing accident, or a young female firefighter was on a tailboard of engine 73. Actually, it was engine 273, and she was assisting the driver to back that engine down out of a cul-de-sac after a structure fire. In the process, she passed out, or at least that's what they're pretty sure happened, and fell off the tailboard and underneath the backing vehicle, and nobody saw it happen or was able to stop the rig in time, and she was crushed to death. It was horrible. My station was moved up into that station to cover for that crew. They took them out of service. They were fairly traumatized by the whole thing, and so I had the misfortune of seeing those guys come back to the station, and the looks on their faces, and just the officer, who's a good friend of mine to this day, and how bad he felt about what happened. So shortly after that, within a week or so, my brother, who is not a firefighter, he's a contractor, builder, welder, but we were together at a family gathering. We began to talk about there's got to be a better way to back these vehicles, a safer way, and we began to work on it. We looked at and began considering dead man safety switches, for example, for a spotter or somebody on a tailboard,
right,
that would signal that driver to stop in the event that something happened to the spotter.
Right. And just for our listeners, understand that this particular incident, and I don't think there's hopefully no fire departments out there today that are actively riding people on tailboards. But it does occasionally happen when you're backing up or rack, as a back east we call it, rack in a supply line,
right?
That somebody will be standing on the tailboard, all right, with the buzzer system. Or I know there's a couple of jurisdictions that still mandate the installation of the buzzers, but say they can't be any more than 42 or 48 inches from the ground, with the thought that, all right, now you're standing next to the rig, so your hand can be out there to hit the buzzer when you want the guy to stop. So whether you're on the tailboard or anywhere near the vehicle when it's backing up, we say, okay, well, we don't ride on the tailboard, but you still have that near occasion of sin that you're potentially putting yourself in harm's way if something goes wrong.
That's right. And I think the differentiation, initially we were riding two fires on the tailboard, lights and siren, hanging on for dear life on the back of that tailboard. That was dangerous, and of course, if that vehicle got in an accident, those guys on that back were lucky if they survived that. So we stopped doing that. The exception was backing, because backing you're doing at a low rate of speed. There was actually a great utility to having that firefighter on that tailboard, finger on the button. That firefighter could stop that rig. He was back there in the back, had peripheral vision, had depth perception, and a brain. And judgment, in other words. So there that tailboard member that backed the vehicle for the city of Los Angeles saved countless accidents. Now, along comes the Jamie Foster incident and other incidents where firefighters have been injured or killed. And the NFPA and the other agencies, NIOSH and OSHA, recommended nobody on that tailboard while that rig is moving. And I think that was a good recommendation in the long run. For us, what that meant was, let's adapt. Let's give that firefighter the ability that he or she had on that tailboard to signal the driver to stop. Let's give that to the firefighter, but let's put them way back and out of the way. Let's do it with remote control, radio frequency. It's a thing that we use every day, and it's a common technology. And so we developed the reverse control system that essentially is a virtual tailboard button for the spotter, and it allows the spotter to get way back out of the way of that backing vehicle and yet signal the driver that he's okay to back up or to stop instantly. And it incorporates a dead man safety switch for the spotter, so that if they drop the device in the process, there's an immediate signal to the driver to stop.
See, one of the things that intrigued Mike and I about your system was that many departments have gone in the way of other technology and think that they've solved the problem or removed any potential for having an apparatus accident or an apparatus on person accident. Incident by saying, well, we've got a backup camera back there, or we've seen units with a combination of a backup camera and another device which physically gets attached to the tailboard that if you're going at less than 5 or 7 miles an hour is going to lock up the brakes. With the thought being that, say, well, if you go get picked up at an airport and all those other vehicles that you see there that operate around those perimeters, they have cameras, and we've now adopted it into the fire service. And I think some people, to my way of thinking, have foolishly thought, we now have a foolproof or bulletproof system. I just don't like the idea of saying if you're backing up a vehicle, and understand, Mike and I've taught in places where people say, we got drive-through bays. And then they think, okay, I got to drive through station bay, means you're never going to back up. Well, you look at that tragic incident you had in Los Angeles, you had to back up out of a cul-de-sac. At some point in time, you'd say for our listeners, if you operate a fire truck and if you can be 110% sure that you are never going to put that unit in reverse, then you might want to lock that out of the transmission and don't allow the people to back up. And if you can prove that to your satisfaction, then you probably don't need any kind of backing device, all right?
Right.
But at some point, I would suspect that unit is going to have to back up somehow, some way. And if you allow the driver, in my estimation, to back up using, even if he's got a backup camera, he can't be looking in both mirrors and looking at the screen to see what's behind him. And sooner or later, something's going to – it's just a matter of time.
So. That's right. It's the driver's at an enormous disadvantage. Imagine operating a vehicle forward with the windshield blacked out. Okay, and that's basically what a driver has to do when he's backing up. So we use spotters. It's the best way. The cameras are a fine tool. I'm not here to disparage the cameras, but the cameras have limitations. They can give a driver, like you said, a glance backwards when he gets into that vehicle. It's really not a good idea to back while you're looking into that camera.
Right. I don't, for me personally, I don't want the driver watching TV. If I'm out there risking my neck helping the driver back up, I want the driver watching me as the spotter.
That's right.
You watch TV on your own time.
That's right. Well, that's a good point. And the thing is we've all learned to back the vehicles. We need to use both mirrors, right and left side, to do it safely. If we're coming into the station, for example, we're in a back-end station, that driver should be keeping an eye on that left column and that right column as he's coming in a back-and-forth method. Now, the interesting part of this, Tom, is most SOPs for backing, most departments will say now, if you lose sight of that spotter who's back there and he's waving you back, and let's say you lose sight of him because you're backing from sunlight into shadow. And I could see him a little bit back there, but, if he was giving me a hand signal to stop, I might miss it. Or let's say I'm backing on an arc, which often we do to come into quarters. It's very difficult to keep that spotter in view. If I look for a moment to the right in my right mirror, and I had him in my left mirror, I'm out of communication with that driver. So what Kurt and I tried to do with our product was to maintain communication with the driver constantly. We do that with a green LED in the cab that illuminates green in both mirrors, in the field of vision of both mirrors. So wherever that driver's looking, he's got a green light that tells him, the spotter's telling me, I'm good to go, I'm good to back. As soon as that spotter lifts off of that button, lights turn red, they flash red, they get the driver's attention to apply the brakes now. No questions. Put the brakes on and stop. So it just greatly improves that ability for spotter and driver to communicate to stop. And it's done simply. It's not a verbal. It's something that from a standpoint of perception is instantaneous, and it's double. Well, you get a tone, and you get a light. So we've been testing it in Los Angeles for it's been a couple of years. The latest system has been tested for the past year in Los Angeles, and we're very happy to report that they've been specified on LA's new engines that are coming, 23 of them. And we're hopeful at some point when the economy gets better that a retrofit of the entire fleet will be out there.
As folks say, Captain, I mean, you can't put a price on safety. And those departments where the overall adding options to the price of an apparatus, we discussed the other day about the NFPA requirement to restrain hose loads. And there was a recent example out in Massachusetts where some hose let go out of a responding engine and injured a passing civilian as they went by. And it's like there's a lot of things that we have in the standard that people think Well, that's kind of like optional. I really don't have to pay attention to that. Brother Mike is taught at a number of military installations, and there at a person at any DOD installation, even if I'm out doing some apparatus photography and the driver's got to back up, he pulls somebody out of the station and he's got a backer. These people are pretty yeah. serious about that.
Yeah.
We unfortunately have taken the attitude, I think, in a lot of fire service applications that we'd rather spend money on some other ancillary technology that doesn't involve a person having to do something. And again, we're not here to beat up the cameras or the other devices, but to me, it almost provides a false sense of security. Like, I got that base covered. If I slide, I'm going to be safe. Well, you still might not be safe.
Right.
Mike and I have done some work with departments that had some of these other devices that they either had near misses with civilians or in some cases did some pretty substantial damage to the apparatus under the guise that they thought they were okay,
right,
and they weren't.
Right.
Now again, I mean, you can fix a fire truck even if it's, you know, $30,000 or $40,000. You run over somebody or you injure or kill, as with the very tragic situation that happened in your department, Captain, and you just, you know, you don't step back up to the next day and recover from that very readily.
You know, Tom, Four people died last year in 2009 under fire apparatus. They were backed over by fire apparatus. And then two of those four cases, they were civilians, which is just a horrible tragedy. The lesser tragedy is the thousands of backing accidents that occur that were minor, but that cost the departments out there quite a bit of money. So our and forgive me for the sales pitch here, but our feeling is look, you put this device on the vehicle, and you got a vehicle that has, what's the service life of a fire engine now, Tom? Is it 12, 15
yeah,
years,
I
depending
mean,
on, you know?
You know, probably in a good economic times on Mike's job, I mean, because it's some contractual obligations, I replace them at 10. I'd say if you probably take an average, it's probably 12 to 15.
Yeah.
And unless our economy turns around, it's going to be longer than that, because
right.
most people, if you're fighting in a career department where so much of your budget is dedicated to personnel services and everything, the amount of discretionary funds you have to spend, and again, apparatus backing accidents, which thankfully tend to be relatively minor in nature, you know, in the $5,000 to $10,000 range, you don't initiate your insurance for that in most cases. The cities are self-insured. So, I mean, that's coming out of the coffers. And
right.
If you had a couple of minor apparatus accidents each year in a modest-sized fleet, that would probably more than pay for looking at putting your system there and combining both things, combining the human component together with the technology that you've been able to harness and make it, to my humble estimation, probably about as bulletproof as I've seen, you know, out there in the marketplace.
Well, thanks, Tom. I mean, that's what we feel. You, in the service life of a vehicle, you prevent one accident with our system, you've paid for it. If you prevent somebody from getting their foot run over, you've probably outfitted your department. And if you prevent a death, unfortunately already this year, there was a fire chief in south of Kansas City that was crushed between two rigs. Our system, I believe, with all of my heart and soul, would have prevented that man's death, and that's priceless. There's no, you don't put a price on
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, and I think one thing that I had read several years ago, that 28% of all fire apparatus accidents happen while the vehicle is in reverse.
That's right.
A high number, considering that those events are just absolutely preventable.
They're That's
just,
right.
Yeah, for some of the insurance companies that underwrite, you know, casualty and liability insurance for departments across the nation, when you have a backing accident, and there's a lot of departments, and this to me is very strong parallel to like the seatbelt policy. People say, do you have a seatbelt policy? And, you know, most people, you know, have half a lick of sense. Absolutely, we have a seatbelt policy. And then you watch them go out on a couple of runs and like, well, you got a policy, but it's not being enforced.
Right.
And it'll be the same thing. So do you have a backing policy? Oh, yeah, you have to have a backer. And then you watch the first time something happens, like, guy didn't get a backer. You know, he threw the thing in reverse and backed into the station at Mach 4 and set the maxi brakes, calls it good. And like a lot of things that Brother Mike has written about, it, like, it's not important and it's not a big deal till it happens to you. or it happens to somebody in your jurisdiction, and then it becomes a big deal from a liability standpoint, from a just completely, and again, going back to the unfortunate incident you had in the LAFD, just the what it does to the morale in the department. You don't come back, and if that happens in the fourth inning, at the ninth inning, you haven't forgot about it.
In Elizabeth, New Jersey, it was January of.
Was it 08?
It was 08.
Yeah.
Okay. A 28-year veteran of their department, the captain, had a working fire, was helping to back that guy down the street. They had a bumper sensor system on that vehicle, I understand. And one of his best friends on the job was driving, and horribly he apparently slipped or fell or whatever in maybe icy conditions. And his career was over, and that man who was operating that vehicle, it wasn't his fault, but that just shouldn't be. It does not need to be. And, again, with the reverse control system, I think we're going to, as we get out there, get the word out there, and thank you again for having us today, we'll begin to see those numbers drop. We'll change the way that we back, and we'll make it safer. We'll get that spotter out of the way. We'll give them the dead man safety switch. We'll give that driver the drivers that. Let me one quick story. We've gone out. We've put this device on vehicles and let companies test them, and then we come back and take them off. They're not happy when this device comes off, because it really gives the driver a great sense of security in knowing that he can be stopped. He can be stopped in a moment's notice.
Right, he can focus on the things that
he can focus. That's right. He can focus on driving. He can pay attention to his right and left mirrors, and back that vehicle with confidence. So,
well, Captain, just to wrap up here, for people who may be interested in the product and wanting. Can have access to the internet, how can they get a hold of you folks or check out your product?
Come and see us at www.reversecontrol.com. We've got a website there that basically explains the system, and it's easily adapted on an aftermarket install. A lot of the OEMs now are beginning to are getting experience in putting on as a specification for a new vehicle. And so, yeah, we're there for you. If you've got questions, call us, write us on the info site, and we're anxious to make backing safer in this country.
Well, certainly appreciate it, Captain. Brother Mike, any other parting thoughts here before we sign off? And we need to check the weather forecast in San Diego, see if we maybe didn't get a few inches of snow since we started out.
No,
here.
It's just wonderful outside as we look out over the great San Diego Bay Area. We've had a great time here in San Diego. I'd like to thank the captain for coming by, and just the East Coast and the West Coast, we can get along. It's been a wonderful experience. I learned a lot just sitting here during the broadcast, and people make that Mississippi River, that great divide, they make it, I think, more than it really is. And as different as we are, we have a lot more similarities, I think, and we operate pretty much the same. So,
and Mike, I've learned something, although with Captain Chris Ulrich from the Los Angeles City Fire Department, I've now learned that if the next time I knock on the door of a task force station, I'm going to ask to see the captain one. I need to be specific. I want to talk to the engine guy. You know, if I need to get permission of the captain to get the rigs moved around, I'll have to suck up a little bit there. But I'll know the appropriate protocol. So
yeah.
For Captain Chris Ulrich, our guest today from the Los Angeles City Fire Department, for Brother Mike and Tom, this is the Apparatus Architects. Please, for our listeners out there, if there's anything that questions that you have, they can be sent in to podcast@firehouse.com. And for all the listeners, drive and operate safely and be safe out there. Take care.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Mike.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.